The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this path is very much about knowing. And sometimes even the word, you know, mindfulness is talked about as the kind of knowing faculty. And in the kind of evolution of the path, many of the ways the Buddha talks about the maturation, spiritual maturation, is coming to know more, coming to know things as they are in themselves. But at the same time, this path is also very much about not knowing. And I'm reminded of Rilke, who asks us in those famous lines to love the questions and to live the questions. And so this morning I wanted to reflect on knowing and not knowing and how these fit together. So I'm not a scholar, but what I've been told in the translation of vipassana, vi is something, it gets translated in three different ways, as something like to kind of separate, or like through, or in a special way, and passana as seeing. So to see through, to see in a special way, to see separately, meaning to untangle the strands of experience, which is such a core project in the Buddhist path, we ask, what is life? And life seems just like this big thing, big blob, and you know, it's like life. But the Buddha says, no, look more carefully. It's that sense that it's just one thing, or that experience is just one thing, that's actually keeps us stuck in ways. And so we're asked to instead to look more deeply, to know more deeply. Now we have this capacity to know what we're experiencing, this awareness, and this is so omnipresent that we sort of overlook it as a resource for our spiritual liberation. This is Joseph Goldstein saying, we often miss the simplicity of bare knowledge because we look through it or over it for something special, or we look forward in expectation and miss what's right in front of us. And so we come to know that there is the breath, that there is the body, that there is pleasant and unpleasant, that the mind has attitudes which flavor our very experience of life. We come to know all of this, and this is of great importance because without knowing, we essentially entrust our lives to habit. That habit, we could say, maybe is the path of least resistance, right? It's like it doesn't take energy to be habitual, right? It's just like that is the path of least resistance. Yeah. And so many of those habits get a bad name in Buddhism, but so many of our habits are great and helpful and work really well for us. And some get us in incredible amounts of trouble, right? And this is why it was these habits the Buddha was alluding to when he said to move against the stream, that we, that this path is moving against the stream. And so without this knowing quality, without mindfulness, we just by nature of our bodies and conditioning, evolutionary history, without mindfulness, maybe we could say that every pain is unbearable and every pleasure irresistible. And that's the just natural, innocent habits of the mind, body. And so we're coming to know, to be aware of our habits, to be aware of the tendency to push and pull on experience. We're coming to know ourselves, right? That famous maxim of know thyself. And this is injunction to know thyself. There are, it's when you look at it empirically, when you look at how well we know ourselves, it's a little humbling. So for example, if I describe my behavior, if I'm asked a bunch of questions, describe my behavior, and then you ask the people in my life, tell me about Matthew's behavior. The overlap, there's overlap. It's not like those two circles are here. There is overlap. But it's not one circle, right? There's kind of some recent scientific interest in this phenomena specifically, and how we come to know ourselves and what the barriers to knowing ourselves are. And there have been two things that have been highlighted. There's a kind of informational barrier and a motivational barrier. So the informational barrier is that we actually, without some kind of formal way of pausing and looking deeply, we actually don't really know what it's like to be human. We think we know. You know, if you had asked me before I started meditation, you know, Matthew, do you know what it's like to be human? Yeah, I do, right? It's like it's the most obvious thing in the world, right? But in a more serious way, you know, like how much could I actually say about what it's like to be human? How much could you say about what it's like to be human the day you started practice until now? It's probably quite different, right? We actually come into this very simple, open relationship with what it's like to be human. And so we know this is how it is to, this is how the mind functions. This is how attention functions. This is what it's like to have this heart that moves so easily, this body that's so sensitive. We pay attention to our behavior, right? And so there's a kind of, we come to know ourselves, we come to know ourselves through more information, better quality and quantity of information. This is one side. The other side is the motivational piece, how mindfulness helps us know thyself. There are so many ego protective mechanisms that lead to the lack of overlap between those two circles. And because it seems like the default position is just to take ourselves very seriously and to make it our life's purpose of kind of manicuring our sense of self. It's hard to actually look in a kind of truly curious way. It's hard to know thyself when it feels like there, the stakes about what we'll find are so high when we take ourselves so seriously. And so we know that that quote from Mark Twain of self-knowledge doesn't always come as good news, right? And that's true to some extent, but only if we are living in a world of self-identification. Otherwise, self-knowledge is just news. And valuable. So this is a psychologist, Erica Carlson, who writes, despite the privileged access we have to our feelings, thoughts, and behaviors, informational and motivational barriers often prevent us from seeing ourselves as we really are. There's some evidence that mindfulness may overcome these barriers and that self-knowledge is an outcome of mindfulness. Future research that directly examines the empirical link between mindfulness and self-knowledge will have important implications for mindfulness and self-knowledge, as well as practical consequences for individuals who desire to improve self-knowledge. So knowing ourselves, we come to know in this path what can and cannot make us happy. That most basic and intimate concern of happiness. And so we come to examine what's our model of well-being. What do we think is going to do it for us exactly? Because at some level we're all working, we're all living our philosophy of happiness. We're living that. And so we actually look like what is that? And we try to learn, like, what actually brings us well-being? You know, what actually does it? And so many of the kind of inherited beliefs about what's supposed to do it, we find it doesn't pan out in the ways that culture suggests. And so we look critically, like, what is happiness? What will do it? Yeah. Kensei Rinpoche, this great line about kind of seeking refuge in wealth, power, fame, these things. And, you know, these false refuges. And he said it's like running after a rainbow in hopes of wearing it as a coat. Yeah. We come to know the Four Noble Truths. We come to know the Four Noble Truths as a way, as a kind of touchstone. And that becomes a kind of guiding framework for how we understand experience, that we, as we live, we're continually touching the Four Noble Truths. We come to know the necessity of a heartfelt path. A path with heart, right? That well-being is, the deep forms of well-being are inextricably bound to the open heart. There's something very deeply linked there. Or another way to put it is that there's no such thing as a kind of close-hearted happiness. We come to know this. Dalai Lama said suffering is experience enslaved to ignorance. So we get a flavor, the kind of value of knowing ourselves, knowing the present moment, knowing what can and cannot make us happy, knowing the value of the heart. But then there's this other side, right? So maybe you know that story, the Zen story. I haven't, or barely practiced in Zen, so if I'm getting the story wrong to any Zen folks, I apologize, but it's a good one. I couldn't resist telling it, even though I've only heard it like third hand or something. But so the professor of Buddhism comes in, I think, to the Zen master and to have tea and ask questions about the meaning of life. I think it's clear in the interaction that, it's a professor kind of expert on knowing, right? And they sit down and they're, pouring tea, and the Zen master is pouring the tea into the professor's cup and is not stopping, and the tea is getting higher and higher, and then it's at the brim of the cup, and then it starts to overflow, and the professor is sitting there and it's like tea running all over the table, right? And naturally the professor asks, like, what's going on here? And the Zen master said something like, the cup is full of tea and can hold no more, your mind is full of views, and so you can't know Zen. Yeah. And this speaks, of course, to the value of not knowing. So that's Zen, but this is a Columbia neuroscience researcher who's recently become a kind of advocate for honoring the not knowing in science. And so this is Stuart Feierstein says, one needs to develop a taste for ignorance, for the unknown, for the place that's just past the comfort of the fact. If you like a fact too much, have too good a feeling about a discovery you've just made, beware. Your brain is fooling you into thinking that the job is done when in fact it's just begun. The real value of your new discovery is the ignorance it has unveiled, ignorance that we didn't even know was there. There's no greater discovery than that of a new unknown, a new thing to be mystified by, a new place to explore. And this is, in fact, the very nature of the structure of science is nothing is definitively proven as true. It's more like it hasn't been proven wrong yet. That's the status of knowledge. It's a model of disconfirmation. And so there may be incredible amounts of evidence for one thing or another, but its status still rests as open to falsification, open to being wrong. In spiritual practice, the value of kind of wonder is so central to practice. Wonder and willingness to be wrong, willingness not to know. So this is Joseph Goldstein again. A new mantra began to form in my mind. Who knows? This not knowing is not a quality of bewilderment. It's not a quality of confusion. It's actually like a breath of fresh air, an openness of mind. So many of our views bubble out of the kalesas. That is, so many of our views of, all our kind of grand theories about what the world is like. So when we look in a really honest way, we can see how the forces of craving, aversion, and unconsciousness proliferate views. Yeah. And it happens in this very subtle way where we don't even notice that the view is born out of kilesa, defilement. It happens to me all the time. I'm just like averse to, I just don't like something. And out of that springs the new theory of everything. Right? Yeah? And so we learn to kind of drain some of the investment from view, to investigate where this bubbles up from. And when we do that, when the kind of emotional investment of this being so, when we start to drain the urgency of that, we're not left with like bewilderment or confusion or no sense of what's right or wrong. But the kind of urgency and insistence of the view, that's gone. Yeah. So there's still a perspective, but it's not, it wouldn't hurt if we were wrong. That's one way to check it out. It wouldn't hurt if we're wrong. Spiritual practice itself is really an encounter with the unknown. When we start practice, when we pick up the meditation practice, we are at least at first, and sometimes at first is years and years. It's like we try to graft in the Dharma to the infrastructure of neurosis, is that, it's a weird way of putting it, but when I came to practice, it was like, okay, I'm just gonna like plug that in to like, it's gonna have this little corner right over here, right? And the Dharma will stay there. It's going to make me calm and just stay right there in that corner. But the Dharma is like a wildfire, you know. It won't, we can sort of get rigid and sort of keep it in that corner for a while, but you keep sitting, we keep practicing, we keep opening, and it wants all of you, right? It's like, it's sort of nature is to water running into the cracks and corners, yeah? It will go there if we let it. Yeah. And because of this, we can't, you know, when we start to open to practice in this way, we can't know what we're getting into. My teacher said that there's no informed consent for enlightenment. Yeah? Like, we can't know. We really can't. The mind tries really hard to, like, take the... to diffuse the mystery out of practice in a way and to make it known, and that's natural. It's like it's disorienting, it's destabilizing in a way to open oneself to a path that you don't know where it's going, to a sense of freedom that you don't imagine yet. Yeah. And so we try to make it known, but it's not. It's the Dharma is always always an adventure in this way. It's always more than we bargain for. Yeah. Now, people. There's also some, you know. Much of this path is about finding ways of connecting to ourselves and to others. And I think in our relationships with people in the Sangha and outside Sangha, this quality of not knowing is valuable. There's value for sure in knowing, right? In knowing that loved one, and you feel like you have such a nuanced map of their inner landscape, right? And that feels great. And it feels great to be known in that way, right? For people who know us deeply, and you know, the basis of empathy, right, is the capacity to fill the other's shoes, right? And that means, that implies a certain level of, of knowing that inner landscape really well. And it's a beautiful feeling to be known in that way. But there's something that's lost if we feel like we utterly know the other. So this is from Philip Roth's book, The Human Stain, which is about a classics professor of Greek and Latin, and I think at, you know, in the story he's maybe 70 or early 70s, and the narrator of the book notices on his shoulder a U.S. Navy tattoo, right? And so this is the narrator's response to seeing this a tattoo on this classics professor, right? A tiny symbol, if one were needed, of all the million circumstances of the other fellow's life, of that blizzard of details that constitute the confusion of a human biography. A tiny symbol to remind me why our understanding must always be, at best, slightly wrong. So what does that do to the mind to look into the eyes of a loved one and say to oneself, like, I don't know you fully. For me, there's a lot of openness and connection in that not knowing. And the psychologist Stephen Mitchell, Stephen A., not the translator, but another Stephen Mitchell, who died some years ago now, he wrote a book called Can Love Last? The Fate of Romance Over Time. And in that book, one of the things that he talked about was this, the very common experience in long-term relationships where people feel like they know each other totally, yeah? And the kind of boredom that can ensue from that, or that sense of familiarity. And one of the intriguing things he said in that book was that that familiarity, that sense of all-knowingness is a kind of manufactured defense against the increasing risk of dependence and love and connection. You know, and that we actually create that sense of completely knowing the other as a way of managing some of the anxiety that comes when we really deeply open the heart to another person. And in this way, that the not knowing is a kind of antidote to that artificially, kind of defensively manufactured stability. We can't be afraid to be wrong in this practice. And we can't be afraid to fail spectacularly. We just will stop practicing if we're afraid of being wrong and failing, if we feel the compulsive need to know. We just won't keep practicing it. Gill said, if you're practicing meditation, you're learning meditation. And I love that line, you know. Like, if we're practicing, we're still learning. Yeah. And like, we arrive and then we know. And then it's just about doing that again and again. We're actually, if we're practicing meditation, we're learning it. After an 8-week mindfulness course or 40 years and years in retreat, right? Nobody said you need to know. We think we're supposed to. But on this path, nobody actually says you need to know. So knowing and not knowing. Let's just sit for a second. whatever goodness is here together, whatever goodness arises out of our practice together this morning. May this be of benefit in small or dramatic ways to all that we encounter. Thank you. Thanks for having me.